Welcome back to the Religious Studies Project. The sort of esoteric, bizarre cultural reference intros are gone for now. Who knows, they might make a return if we have something we particularly want to say. I'm Christopher Cotter. I'm here with...
David Robertson.
We're the Religious Studies Project. Well, no, we're not. We're a very small part of it, to be honest. Brought to you in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions. Today's podcast is an interview that Tommy Coleman recorded with Andrew Johnson on Pentecostalism in the prisons of Rio. And I think without further ado, we'll pass over to Tommy. And after the interview, we'll tell you a little bit more about what's coming up.
Welcome to the Religious Studies Project. This is Thomas Coleman, and I'm here today with Dr. Andrew Johnson. Dr. Andrew Johnson is a research associate at the Center for Religion and Civic Culture at the University of Southern California. He is currently working on a book manuscript and documentary film based on his research on Pentecostal practice inside the a prison in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Andrew conducted the research for the project as a member of the Pentecostal and Charismatic Research Initiative funded by the Templeton Foundation and is interested in studying religious practice on the margins of society. Welcome to the Religious Studies Project, Dr. Johnson.
Hey, thank you, Thomas. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
I just kind of start with some background. I believe I was made aware of your work is the 2014 Society for the Scientific Study of Religion conference is coming up, and I do believe there's going to be a special presentation there. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're actually having kind of the premiere of the documentary film, If I Give My Soul, Pentecostal Practice Inside of Prison in Rio de Janeiro. So I'm looking forward to the October conference, and we're going to premiere the film, and looking forward to it.
Excellent. And this is work you have done actually inside of a prison. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. You know, I was in Rio de Janeiro doing my dissertation research, and the idea to look for different outlets or platforms to talk about the data we were getting. And I thought that some of the traditional academic books and article formats wasn't capturing maybe some of the emotion or some of the intensity of the scenes that I was seeing. And so the idea for a documentary film kind of came from that. And what started with just bringing a flip cam into some of the prisons there, kind of grew, and I was able to find what basically were friends of mine who were freelance film photographers and then a film editor to kind of get this project off the ground. So we have footage from inside of prison and then also of the kind of the religious practice inside of prison, but then also in churches and communities that surround these prisons in Rio de Janeiro.
Just to get kind of some background information going, what prompted you to actually end up locked up inside a South American prison for several days when most people would, try to avoid such an ordeal? And here you are. Couldn't you just walk through the prison and get some of the information that you wanted? Why?
Yeah, I mean, I still think, as a general rule, it's a good idea to avoid these prisons. But I was going to spend a year researching in Rio de Janeiro. And there's prison's got its own separate subculture. And, I grew up in Minneapolis, and this is a lot different setting. And so I really do think that some of the ways to learn about things is to actually have to pass through them yourself. And so having to eat the same food and sleep in the same cells and kind of go through the daily routines of being an inmate is something I thought was really important. And it was things that I couldn't learn by... There's nothing I could read or no film I could watch that would kind of give me some of those insights. And it also taught me a lot of the unwritten rules of Brazilian prisons that really were crucial for the rest of this project. And so I found a situation where I thought I'd be safe, and I was. And I was actually treated with really a lot of hospitality and respect from those guys in there. And so it was a great way to start the project, and I really got an understanding of what incarceration is like on a different level.
Wow. Before we actually go inside the prison, if you could perhaps kind of put us inside the country of Brazil, specifically Rio, kind of with a broad perspective of the overall social and economic climate down there.
Sure. Well, Rio is an interesting place because Rio is, you know, the most visible city in Brazil. It's the, when we see images of Brazil, often there are shots of Rio de Janeiro. And especially now that the World Cup's going to start in a couple weeks and the Olympics are coming in a couple years, Rio is really in kind of a unique place in the global stage. People are talking about Brazil, and when they talk about Brazil, they often talk about Rio. You know, Rio is well known for its soccer, its samba, its beaches and things like that, but it's also pretty well known for its kind of social inequality. There really are two Rios. And almost every film or documentary that's shot in the city has some version of a shot where you see kind of the, you know, luxurious beach houses and hotel properties shot kind of the hillside favelas in the side, trying to show this positioning of rich and poor. And so that's another characteristic of Rio, is this gap in between the haves and the have-nots. And this has, you know, been going on for 500 years. And so this project is really in the in the prisons, and then the vast majority of inmates are coming from these hillside favelas or outlying peripheral neighborhoods. It's coming from the poorer part of Rio. So that's where we are. We're in the most visible city, and we're on kind of on the edges of this visible city.
How did you prepare for this research? What was kind of your research plan, the methodology that you were going to use? What kind of tools did you have?
Well, I had done research in Brazil previously. I'd worked in Sao Paulo before with the kids living on the street there. So I had some kind of understanding of what these urban spaces were like. But the prison is really a unique situation. And so what I did, you know, I talked to people who are involved in prison ministries, but then that's also why I wanted to spend those 2 weeks living inside a prison, because I felt like that would, it was a thing too where I kind of wanted to, didn't want to make myself too vulnerable, but to a certain extent, I didn't want to just come in and ask a series of questions that I had beforehand. So I really wanted to let my prison experience kind of form some of those questions. Because so often people talk about, have these ideas of religion or, you know, jailhouse conversions or religion inside a prison. And I kind of wanted to set some of those aside. And I also didn't want to, you know, just look at prison ministries. I kind of wanted to do the best I could to see what was going on in the cells. One of the reason to kind of form this experience is I went on a prison tour in Angola, Louisiana, and the Angola prison there. And they have a strong prison, you know, I think they have 27 prison ministries operating in Angola. And so I took a tour with one of the prison guards, and I asked if I could see, they actually have a functioning seminary in the prison. And so I asked if I could talk to an inmate who was participating. And so they brought me up to the door, and they asked the guard who I should talk to, and they said, well, you should talk to Charlie. I forget his exact name. And so they hand-selected the prisoner, and they brought him out of the cells, and so I shook hands with Charlie. And as I was asking some of the questions, you know, the prison guard was standing right over my shoulder, and I could see as Charlie was responding back to me about the program, he was also kind of making eye contact with the guard. And so I'm not saying he wasn't sincere in his responses, but I knew I had to do this research kind of outside of the watchful eye of the guard. And so that was one thing that really shaped the methodology, and I was able to find ways to do this. Now in Brazil, the guards often just, they really enter the cell block. They kind of guard the perimeter. So once you get inside the door, it's quite easy to have those sorts of conversations with inmates.
Yeah, I wanted to see if you could go into a little bit about some of the possible differences between the prison system in Brazil. You kind of started on some of that with the guards not actually being in the prison itself in Brazil and in the U.S. How and perhaps other countries. How does the prison system compare?
Well, I can compare the Brazil and the U.S. Those are the two I know the best, and both countries have, you know, high incarcerated populations. The U.S. is much higher, but Brazil's is growing. I think the difference is the level of control of the day-to-day activities of the inmates in these places. In the U.S. prisons, they rely on technology, on a well-trained prison staff, on really, you know, on methods and controlling the movements of the inmates. In Brazil, it's the inmates themselves who decide who sleeps where. And the, for example, the jail that I was at had up to 800 inmates, and at night there was one guard there, and he wouldn't go behind bars for anything. And even during the day, a lot of the inmates are the ones who kind of run things inside of, they set the informal rules, which are basically the formal rules inside of prison. And then the sentences are much shorter in Brazil. I was talking to a prison guard one time, and I knew he was kind of setting me up for this joke, but he says to me, "Hey, have you read the Brazilian Constitution?" I said, "No, I haven't read it," waiting for the punchline. He goes, "Well, what it says is that every Brazilian has the right to kill one person. At the second one, we're going to really punish you." Now, he was joking. But what he was meaning is that the sentences are much shorter in Brazil. And so at Angola prison, 90 to 95% of those guys are going to die in prison because the sentences are so long, no parole, and it has a different feel to it. You're looking to make the best of your time. The rest of your life is going to happen in this place. Whereas in Brazil, you might, for a murder, you might be in prison for 7 years, but 3 to 5 of that might actually be locked up. And so these are much more fluid places, and they're places where you're gonna go back to the community. So the final thing I'll say about the difference is that the conditions, the physical conditions in the Brazilian prisons, what I saw, are much worse than the U.S. as far as overcrowding, food, and basic safety. In the cells that I spent a lot of time in, they had maybe 14 beds that were filled with, at some point, up to 80 men. And so the inmates would sleep head to toe on the concrete bunk beds, and they would sleep head to toe on the floor, and even that wasn't enough space. So many of the inmates would take turns who would get to lay down at a time, and then others would just tie their torsos to the prison bars with a t-shirt or something like that and try to sleep standing up. And so they're really intense places. And so that's one of the differences as well.
As I understand, the people who are locked up in these prisons in Rio, they're known at least locally as the killable people. And what's the local term that they're kind of given? And why are these the killable people?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm trying to work out in my book. I heard that phrase once that someone used, "Os seres matáveis," which directly translates as the killable people. And what this kind of comes from is, if you look at Rio de Janeiro's homicide rates, you have it shows a very violent city. I like to compare it to Chicago, because the Chicago and Rio are about the same size. And Chicago has had, it's better this year, but had some very high homicide rates over the last year. I think it was, last year, the year before, they hit 500 homicides for 1 year. Well, Rio de Janeiro, the metropolitan area, is about the same size, and over the last 10 years, they've had about 6,000 to 6,500 homicides per year. And so you have a level of violence that is really stands out if you compare it to other countries in the Americas, or the world for that matter. It's one of the most violent places, cities on earth. And on top of that, the police kill 1,000 people a year. That could be during arrest, resisting arrest, or police brutality. The end result is they kill 1,000 people a year. So you really have a very high rate of violence. And the people who are dying in these homicides and police killings are really segmented to a certain part of society. They're primarily young, darker-skinned males coming from these favelas or these peripheral neighborhoods, and a lot of them do have ties to drug traffic. And the reason they call them this term, the killable people, is because they can be killed at this incredible rate, and there really hasn't been much of a outcry. There hasn't been much of a reaction. There hasn't been it's been tolerated to a certain extent. And I would say it's because of who is getting killed. If people from the middle class or other segments of society were being killed at this rate, there would be tremendous outcry. And so it's these same killable people who are also going to prison. And one of the unique things about the Brazilian prison system in Rio de Janeiro, there's all sorts of ways to get out of winding up in prison if you have some connection to the middle or upper classes. For example, if you are a part of the army or the police force or even a firefighter, and you're arrested for a certain crime, and it could be a serious crime, you won't be sent to these common jails, sent to better jails. And in fact, just until recently, in some places, if you have a college degree, you're not sent to these jails. And so, much like the draft in the United States, if you had a college degree, you know, essentially a lot of people in the middle and upper classes weren't drafted because of that. In the same way, people who have a college degree in Brazil aren't, or like I said, it's changing now, but haven't been sent to these places. So you really do have a concentration then of people who are poor, from the lower classes, and also kind of fit this, you know, killable person model I'm trying to use.
Kind of bringing in religion now, we have the background on the prison, kind of the socioeconomic situation in the country. How does religion, and I guess specifically the prison ministry or ministries, perhaps, play into the fold down there with regards to the prison?
Sure. Well, one thing, this project is about Pentecostalism, and I kind of say that Pentecostalism is the faith of the killable people, because in these places where you have, in these concentrated areas of poverty, Pentecostalism is by far the dominant faith. In fact, I went to Brazil thinking I would just study religion in general, and then when I started living in these 2 weeks inside of prison, I realized that inside of prison, Pentecostalism is by far the dominant faith. And in the prisons in Rio de Janeiro, it's interesting because when you talk about prison ministries, we think of this church on the outside coming in. And there is some of that, but the core, the motor of this Pentecostal practice inside a prison is actually these inmate-led prison churches. And so what the inmates will hold elections, and they'll vote among the inmates who want to be part of this prison church. They'll vote in a pastor and a worship team and secretaries, and they will claim part of the prison as their own. They have their own cell, or sometimes cells, and they'll live together in community under another set of rules. And so there's very specific rules about no drugs or no swearing or no smoking cigarettes, wearing your shirt during, what you wear during the day, and attending all of the services and worship services and communal fasting deals. And so they have it, you know, if there's a worship service and one person goes from the Pentecostal cells, or they say they, Celas dos crentes, the believer cells, they all go. And if one person stays, they all stay. And so they really have a powerful presence inside of prison, even though they make up about 10% of the prison population.
Wow. You had kind of indicated that the prison ministries have some territory or part of the prison that they claim is their own. I'm also reading that as there are other parts that are claimed by, of course, other entities, other gangs, perhaps.
Yeah, and that's a good point. The prison gangs are the ones who take up some of the power the state might have had. Like I said, the guards really don't go behind the bars for a whole series of reasons, but the prison gangs are the ones who dominate the prisons. They decide who sleeps where, who gets the best spots, the worst spots, who gets killed, who doesn't. They have their own set of rules that they have that dictate everything from what you wear to where you sleep to all sorts of sexual practice, and there's different punishments for different crimes and things like that. And what I'm trying to do in the book is really kind of compare the structure of the prison churches to the prison gangs. Both institutions have a real strong leader, either the gang leader or the pastor. They both provide protection for the inmates. If you're linked to the church or the gang, you're free from some of the random violence or almost any violence that might happen. You have a strong identity. There's no doubt about if you're part of one or the other. There's community, they have community, and they also have kind of a bridge to the outside. You can really further your gang career inside of prison, and you can come out of the with respect and a much higher position in the gang. I met a number of gang members who, when they left prison, were a promotion in because of their prison service and had better, you know, points in the drug traffic. In the same way with the Pentecostal churches, that's one identity that does transfer with you in society. And there wasn't any, I can't think of a church that I went to in Brazil, a Pentecostal church, that didn't have a an ex-gang member or an ex someone who used to be involved in the drug trade, and so that really is an option for ex-inmates that for in a group of people that don't have a lot of options coming out of prison.
What is the relationship between perhaps the gangs and the Pentecostal prison movements? How do they ever clash? Do they get in fights, or are they relative peace and respect with regards to one another?
Yeah, well, I was really surprised how respectful these positions were, because I thought, the gang will basically, if someone converts and wants to live in this prison church, the gang will basically let them go on their own and will say, we won't touch you as long as your conversion is deemed genuine, and we're going to watch how you act day to day. But in the same way, there's kind of a respect in these in the neighborhoods where the gangs dominate between the church and the gangs, in the same way inside of prison. It's really a relationship that's kind of marked by respect. Now, in both the prison and in the neighborhoods, the church doesn't try to forcefully take the power away from the gang. And so, they're not trying to claim the prison as their own, nor are they trying to govern their own neighborhood. They kind of create an enclave on the side and operate with a different set of rules, and the gang really has respect for that. I think there's some cultural reasons, but I also think that there are some reasons because of they can see the change in people's lives. Inside of prison, there's not a lot of space to say one thing at church and then act a different way. You're being watched. There's a sense of community, or you're being monitored at least pretty much 24 hours a day, and so I think that there is a kind of a respect for people who are able to abide by the very stringent lifestyle expectations.
Of course, it wouldn't be at all strange to find religion being used, this category being used for strategic political purposes in any country. How might it, how does it get, how does this category, this term, these prison ministries get perhaps used for political ends in the prison or even in the government?
Well, I think you see a lot more of that in the neighborhoods. This Pentecostal movement's really growing in Brazil. Inside of prison, first of all, a lot of people don't know these prison churches exist because these prisons are really hidden spaces. And what I was surprised about, I guess, was the, I should back up and say there are also Pentecostal volunteers from the outside who kind of visit basically day in and day out these inmates. And I remember my first time walk, and I would usually accompany these small groups into the cells, and I would walk into these cells and just be shocked at the horrific conditions of these prisons. And I thought to myself, why aren't these Pentecostals up in arms or beating down the doors of the politicians saying this, we got to change this situation? And I was kind of surprised at the lack of a political response that some of the people had visiting these places. But after visiting there for a while, I also became acclimated to the conditions, so it does kind of become part of your norm day in and day out. But also, it's kind of a continuation, I think, for the people who are from these poor neighborhoods of state intervention or of state services, whether it's, the schools are bad, the healthcare system's bad, the roads are bad, the police system's horrible. So it's not shocking then that the prisons aren't great. And so they maybe had a different response than I did. I also think, though, I start to see things different, that there is political statement by being there. In the book, I'm trying to call it a politics of presence, that being physically present in these spaces with kind of society's most despised people, these killable people, or these are the ones who deserve what they're getting, kind of choosing to side with them as opposed to the police or as opposed to someone else, I think is a political statement. And it's maybe not the traditional way of trying to get behind a candidate or something like that, but embracing a rapist or singing praise songs with a murderer is a countercultural statement that I think has political ramifications, but maybe isn't, certainly took me a while to see it as a political move.
Do the actions and the impact of the prison ministries inside the prison have any impact outside in the general community? I noticed you said that much of the public doesn't even know they exist, but you know, do they have a noticeable effect perhaps in the community where these prison ministries are established?
Yeah, I think they do, because one of the things they do is they visit the inmates' families. And so that's one reason I think the inmates respect these visitors that come in so much, because they are doing things like bringing food to families that need it, or, you know, bringing notes back and forth sometime, or at least just, you know, I can't tell you how many times an inmate said, "Hey, here's a phone number. It's to my grandma. Can you just tell her I'm in here? I've been in here for 2 weeks. No one knows I'm here." And simple things like that. So these pastors or these volunteers kind of serve as a go-between between the inmates and their families. And what happens is that I think the families then know that, hey, these guys are on our side, or, you know, they're not judging us like the rest of society. And so I think that really buys them a lot of influence and respect, not only inside the prisons, but also in the neighborhoods where a lot of the inmates come from.
What makes Pentecostalism so particularly appealing, as opposed to perhaps, you know, Catholicism? I would think that there might be a small Catholic group in there, but instead it's Pentecostals, correct?
Yeah, it's a predominantly Catholic country and a predominantly Catholic city, but it depends on what side of the city you're talking about. And so if you're talking about the more developed and wealthier South Zone or the middle and upper class, it is a predominantly Catholic place. If you're talking about the poor neighborhoods, then it's a predominantly Pentecostal place. And so prison really does kind of reflect that difference. And certainly there are practicing Catholics inside of prison. But one of the reasons it's so strong is because of the presence of these volunteers. When I was living in the prison, I think the number of Pentecostal volunteers to Catholics was over 10 to 1 that I saw during my time there. And in these prisons in Rio de Janeiro, it was closer to 20 to 1. And so for every 20, you know, for every 20 visitors or volunteers who would enter these places, I would say 19 were Pentecostals. So there really is this added emphasis. And then also a lot of the men are in I was studying men's prisons, are coming from these neighborhoods that are Pentecostal neighborhoods. And so even though Brazil is a Catholic, predominantly Catholic country, and Rio is a Catholic city, we're talking about a specific segment of this city. And so I think that's one of the reasons. And then also, you know, there's a lot of the scholars in Pentecostal point to things like you have a direct relationship with God, and this, you know, lost to found narrative, which is works, you know, is important inside of prison, are also. And I also think the practice is important, you know, the having services every night, and it gives people a platform or a mechanism to actually be this new identity, as opposed to just talk about it. They can actually do loving things or things that they think Christians or Pentecostals do.
I suppose the experiential dimension to Pentecostalism, the emphasis on experience, is probably particularly appealing in a prison environment where, you know, the majority of experiences aren't so lovely. I'm guessing, but when we're you have these inmates and who may or may not, I suppose, have been religious beforehand or professed any faith. How do we know that their faith is really sincere? Is it believed to be by the other prison gangs, by the other people in the ministry? How do you know when someone's truly faithful?
That's a great question, and I think that question is above our pay grade as sociologists, deciding, you know, what is actually true. But the question comes up all the time because they're in prison, and so the assumption, and I was surprised how freely people would share this, was that, oh, they're just doing that. They're just doing that to get over on the guards, or to pretend to be on the judge, or to pretend they're good. And I've kind of heard that both in the academic setting and the just talking to people. And so what I decided to do is kind of take a step back and say, I'm not going to worry about the sincerity, but I'm going to look at what they do. Because inside a prison, you can say anything, but what really counts is what you do. And so if the gang releases you from your gang affiliation to the Pentecostals, they watch what you do day in and day out. And the prison church itself watches what you do day in and day out. So I kind of took their lead and said, instead of focusing on if they're really genuine about their commitment, can you see it, you know, change, either a change in behavior, or can, are they following kind of what they say they're going to do? And so I've tried to, you know, I think that you take these either sociological or social science research on religion, I think looking at practice is all of a sudden is very important, and to, you know, not try to necessarily determine who's faking it and who's not. Another thing that I didn't want to do is to study recidivism rates. A lot of the research in the U.S. looks at prison ministries, and they kind of imply that the religion going on there is genuine because they come back at a lower rate than people who aren't in ministries. Well, that all of a sudden puts the justice system, whether in the U.S. or Brazil, that kind of makes them the decider of whose faith is genuine or not. And so one thing in Brazil is that you don't have the data. There isn't data to talk about these recidivism rates. Another thing is that I didn't want to put incarceration status as the determining factor of who is genuine and who is not. I think that for a lot of theological and very practical reasons, like the neighborhoods they're going back to, that this isn't a good way to determine that. So what I wanted to do is say, well, this is what they do, and we can go from there.
Occasionally, we put out some calls and invitations on our the Religious Studies Project social media feeds and invite questions from many of the listeners. And I have one here that came in yesterday from a researcher in Central America, Carmen Guevara, and she asked, how are these prison church members accepted and received in the Pentecostal churches outside of the prison once their, you know, time as inmates has been completed?
Yeah, that's a great question, because that's one of the reasons I started this project. I wanted to see what were some of the links or bridges that people could take from prison into society. And for prisoners, there's not a lot of options. Now, the churches that I visit outside did have inmates in there, so I don't have a sample of all of them. But one thing about Pentecostal churches is that this, you know, your personal testimony or this lost to found narrative is really important. And people who can say, I once was this, I once was a gang member, a murderer, a drug dealer, and now look at me today. People are, what I saw, were very surprisingly welcoming to these people. And also the volunteers who would go inside of prison would tell these inmates, this is where our church is. I would like to see you in the pews, or our doors are open for you. And so there was this active inviting of the inmates to come to their churches. Now, I visited, not all these churches were full of inmates. I mean, that's certainly not the case. But they're going to neighborhoods. They're usually going to churches in the neighborhoods where the inmates come from. So they're not necessarily going to the wealthy churches or the upper class parts of the city. And so that reaction may be very, very different. I didn't do a lot of that research, but in the small kind of storefront neighborhood churches, what I saw is that they were, you know, welcomed.
Did the inmates have any type of an incentive to actually join these prison ministries? You know, the people who actually join the ministries, do they have time shaved off their sentences? Do they have better living spaces, you know, better food? Are there any material incentives, I suppose, to be a part of the prison ministry?
Sure. I mean, you wouldn't get any time shaved off, because, to be honest, the guards really don't know what's going on in there, so they don't know who's part of what. But if you're thrown into prison for a sexual crime of some sort, my first thing I would do is join the Pentecostal church, because if you're part of the church, you're free. I mean, you're kind of off limits from other repercussions for what you have done on the outside or things like that. So it can certainly be a place of refuge for people who have, our lives are on the line. Now, once again, as we were saying, I didn't necessarily make those judgments of why people were in the church. But if you do join the church, then you have to abide by the church's rules. So for example, there was a case in one of the larger prison that I was at, and they found one of the church members was sexually abusing another younger, weaker member. So the pastor got his team together, and they decided what to do, and they brought this guy to the warden, said what he had done, and the warden transferred him to kind of the worst part of the worst prison, which is almost essentially a death sentence. And so if you're going to make a public claim and say, I'm going to convert and follow, in this case, follow Jesus or be part of the church, then you are expected to back that up with your daily actions. And if you don't, there is another set of consequences. So,
Kind of wrapping up the interview here, I was wondering if you wouldn't mind speculating or drawing some conclusions about the future of these Pentecostal charismatic type movements in the prison, specifically in South Central America there. I don't know if they're in any of the other states there, but at least in Brazil.
Yeah, well, I can just speak to Brazil, I guess. And to be honest, I think that as the technology, for example, the jail that I did a lot of the work at is now closed because there's so many human rights violations, and they're doing a different sort of prison system, one looks more like the U.S. to be honest with you. And so I think as they have more technology and they have more control over the daily lives of inmates, that there'll be less space to have these inmate leaders. For example, in the United States. I've done some work in the prison in New Jersey and they do not want to have any inmates with any sort of religious authority. Now, a lot of this is done to make sure Islamic, it's mostly done to make sure Muslim leaders don't rise up, but basically any religious activity or leadership by inmates is strongly discouraged, and they want to have the guards, you know, as the, well, they don't want to do that. So I think as Brazil starts to improve their prisons, there may be less space for inmates to, you know, take over a cell or two cells and say, this is how we're doing life here. But I'm not certain about that. Even in the maximum security prisons, though, there are these prison churches. It's every prison I visited, whether it's the smallest jail or the largest maximum security penitentiary, had an inmate-run, independent, autonomous prison church in it.
Is there anything you'd like to add to the interview that you feel maybe we haven't covered, or some final takeaway points for our listeners?
We'll see. I guess when I think of kind of some of the takeaway points, I think for me is one, I always like to say, you know, I was really treated well by these guys. The first day walking in, I thought to myself, this is in Rio de Janeiro, boy, I would make a great hostage in this situation, because you're there with 400 inmates and no guards, and pastors would bring in their 15 and 16-year-old daughters or wives into these spaces with kind of the worst, what are considered kind of the worst people in the city, and we would go in, and men would put their shirts on, they would stop smoking, and they would kind of form an aisle, and so they're very reverent places. Another thing I would like to, you know, kind of like to with this is to, I think the religious lives of inmates are worth taking seriously, apart, detached from recidivism rates. So to look at what they do as something that's worthy of study, regardless whether they come back or not, or whether it quote unquote works, and I think that is one thing. And then also, I think this is an interesting glimpse of, you know, this Pentecostalism is growing so fast, especially in places like Latin America, or has grown so fast. And this gives a little glimpse of maybe why it has been so successful in specifically impoverished areas, that you have, you know, inmates who have almost no education, who can rise up to pastor or deacon or things like that without going through some of the formal channels like seminary or formal education. So this kind of empowers, it's flexible enough where it empowers, can empower people who are otherwise kind of thrown to the edges. Now, on the flip side of that, you have all sorts of craziness that goes in when you're just kind of an independent church. And you can see whether it's, you know, they talk about prosperity theology or sometimes just a relationship between pastors and criminals is not legal. You saw some of that as well. So there's a lot of gray area in there. But yeah, that's it. And then also I hope to that more sociologists start thinking about showing their work through film. It's a different medium, and I've really enjoyed it, and I think it has some benefits that the academic journals and even books can't pull off.
On that note, I'd like to thank again Dr. Andrew Johnson for joining us today on the Religious Studies Project, and also include again a little plug for Andrew's new documentary that is coming out. It's titled If I Give My Soul, and it further details his work on Pentecostalism in the prisons of Rio, and he will be hosting a world premiere yes. of this film at the 2014 Society for the Scientific Study of Religion Conference at a plenary session this fall in Indianapolis, Indiana. So I believe that's at the end of October. So Dr. Johnson, thank you for having on the program today.
Hey, thank you very much. It was great to be here. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tommy. We've decided not to have ongoing series as we have done on occasion in the past.
Last couple of years.
Yeah. For this next year, we just thought it's off-putting for people who aren't interested in the broader things, and anyone who's edited a book or a journal or anything else will know that you do end up kind of forcing things slightly into categories that they don't necessarily need to do. So we've decided to, rather than that, we'll just allow the connecting threads to emerge as we go along, much like fungus develops in a rich compost.
And a lot of this is to do with the fact that, you know, we've now well past 120 episodes, and to start to find new themes that we haven't already slightly explored would be, you know, sort of an artificial exercise, but also current interviews that we're doing are tying in more and more to threads that have already been explored slightly in previous podcasts. So where we notice connections, we'll flag them up. Where you notice connections, please flag them up. And it's hoped that as the website develops, this is going to be one of the key areas that we're trying to develop. We'll be enabling searching by theme, where you can, you know, pull up all the podcasts and resources that we've produced on particular themes. So yeah, just let us know your thoughts on that if you want. I was going to say a little bit about, David talked last week about the BASR conference. I was not there this year because I was invited.
You got headhunted.
I got headhunted. But I was invited because I knew the conference organizer, Gladys Ganiel, who we're interviewing in a few weeks actually on the podcast, and she knew that I was one of the Chris and David of the Religious Studies Project, so she asked me as part of that Chris and David combo to come and serve as a discussant at the close of conference roundtable session for the European Sociological Association's Research Network for the Study of Religion conference in Belfast. So I was at that, got a couple of interviews, one with Kevin Gray on the post-secular, and one with Veronique Alclas on bricolage. And the conference was on the theme of religion in the public domain, so I'll not say too much about it, because I'll hopefully turn my discussant summary into a report for the Religious Studies Project. But, you know, it was interesting to be there. And but what I focused on was issues around what is public. Does the notion of religion have any meaning if it's private, or does it have any social relevance if it is entirely private? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. But also one of the keynotes was Professor John Brewer, who's also from Queen's University Belfast. He was talking about the public value of the sociology of religion, and that's something that we've had a special podcast on. And I just asked a few critical questions about which public are we serving, and by giving people what we want, what they want, are we not complicit in the very power structures of the society we're meant to be critiquing? It also provided a nice platform for me to flag up the sort of religious studies project book, as it were, that David and I are working on, which was dealing with similar issues with the world religions paradigm. If people expect that from universities, should we be giving it to them, or yeah. or how do we avoid that? So it was a nice platform, and it seemed to go down well. Got the RSP some good publicity, so just thanks to Gladys and the ESA for that opportunity.
Yeah, and look out for those podcasts coming up later. There's more than just that one. There's a couple of others.
Next week, then?
Well, next week is going to be an interview I recorded with Leonard Primiano at the BASR. Leonard's... if you heard the interview I did with Marion Bowman... it's probably a couple of years ago now, at least a year and a half, on the subject of vernacular religion.
Which she mentioned 2012.
Oh, so okay, yeah,
over so 2 years,
more than 2 years. Right. Okay. Then you may remember her mentioning Leonard Primiano during the interview. Anyway, so it was a pleasure to meet and interview him, and I got him to talk more about. The US context of the study of vernacular religion, because it's a bit different. Myth and popular discourse doesn't mean quite the same thing in a country of, you know, a 200 or 300 year history, rather than, you know, one with that disappears into the far off history. So there's a slightly yeah. different perspective there. So the idea of folk religion is not quite the same as what we would tend to mean, but nonetheless it's a really interesting interview.
Excellent.
And I think we're going to rerun the Marion Bowman interview as a because they belong together, I think.
They do.
Yeah. Other than that, the usual beats. You can find us on Facebook, Google+, iTunes,
Twitter
indeed, at Project RS. Use our Amazon links if you can. That's a great help to us. And thanks to the BASR, as ever, for sponsoring us. But until next week,
thanks for listening.